What a remarkable privilege we have as the children of God to know the truth. You know, not many people know the truth today. That's not bragging, that's just the facts. Not many people know the truth. And to know the truth in an age of confusion is really a wonderful privilege. When I was young, I was watching my brother put gas in the car. We used to live on a farm, and there was an old gas tank and had a crank on it, and my brother was cranking gas, and I was looking down in the gas tank. I was wondering how he could possibly tell when it was full. He pulled out the gas nozzle, and it was full to the brim, and gas splashed out of the gas tank into my eyes, and it stung terribly, hurt terribly. So I was about four years old. Started screaming bloody murder and running for the house, only I ran the wrong direction, heading out across the cornfield. And my brother grabbed me by the arm. He said, "Fred," I had my eyes closed tightly. I didn't know where I was going. I just wanted to get to Mom, you know. And he grabbed me by the arm. He said, "Fred, the house is this way." I said, "No, it isn't. No, it isn't." He said, "Yes, it is." He grabbed me and he hauled me over to the house. Got my eyes fixed up. But you know, it's a wonderful thing to have the Lord Jesus take us by the arm and say, "This is the way. This is the way. You walk this way. This is the way of safety. This is the way of deliverance. You go this way." The world is wandering in darkness today, and that's the truth. And Christians are walking in the light. I want to talk this morning in continuation of what I began in Sunday school on the topic of Satan's design for the earth. Last week we discussed the counterfeit kingdom, and I mentioned then how Satan is forming Babylon in terms of a world system. He's making up a world system that he will rule personally in the person of the Antichrist. And on the topic of this system, I mentioned that it's built on the basic fallacy of self-determination of man instead of God-determination. Instead of letting God be the one who shows us the way, the one who tells us what the straight path is, the one who directs us. Man would like for himself to be the God of this world. And this is the temptation that Satan put before Eve. You shall be as gods. And this is what appealed to her. And so I mentioned that this idea of man being God has its embodiment in what is called the philosophy of secular humanism. And I read the identification, the definition of it during the Sunday school hour. I'll mention it again because I'm going to continue in our sermon this morning on the topic of how this leaven has been leavening through the society of the world. It isn't particularly a Bible topic, but we have a situation that exists right now. It dwells squarely on the questions, on the truths, on the directions the Bible gives us, and yet what we're seeing is a great deal of confusion concerning the Bible. And so we need to go back and reach out and see if we can to draw out those confusions, those mixtures, that Babylonish mixing that Satan has put into the world. Secular humanism is a doctrine, attitude, or way of life centered on human values, not on God's values. It doesn't matter to the humanist what God thinks. God's standard is not the standard. The only standards they recognize are those things that can be measured or experienced, and those things that suit man's purposes. It's a doctrine, attitude, or way of life centered on human values, especially a philosophy that asserts the dignity and worth of man and his capacity for self-realization and reason. His capacity for self-realization. It doesn't matter what God wishes man to be, it's what man can make of himself. Well, you might ask, what does he want to make of himself? And the answer is, whatever seemeth good unto him. That's what he wants to make in himself. Whatever looks right is what he will try to do. Self-realization through reason, and it also adds in the definition of secular humanism that humanism rejects supernaturalism. Humanism rejects supernaturalism. Do you know why? Because as Heraclitus said, the Greek philosopher, man is the measure of all. Man is finite. Man's ideas, what man can see, what man can do, what man can envision, what man considers to be right, is all in all. He is the determining factor of the universe. This is the core of what Satan set before Eve when he said, ye shall be as gods, discerning between good and evil. You will be as gods, discerning between good and evil. Make your own standards and forget God's standards. Now, I mentioned again, and I need to recap this briefly, that this brings us squarely into the concept of situation ethics, relativism, in a moral standpoint. Because morality is simply gauged on what is good for man or what seems to be good for man, not what is good to God. And so, as I mentioned, victimless crimes are suddenly no longer crimes at all. Illicit sexual activity between consenting adults, there's nothing wrong with that. The only one who objects to it is God. And who is God in a humanistic society? You don't care about the absolutes. All humanism cares about is what suits purposes. And so, as I mentioned, there is a quotation regarding the concept of humanism. I'm having to page through my notes here to find it. Regarding morality, to the effect that anything that does not serve the human good, anything that isn't specifically seen as being useful, then is thrown out. Traditional dogmatic or authoritarian religions that place revelation, God, ritual, or creed above human needs and experience do a disservice to human species. This is the lie. This is the idea that is being set there. And so while God says, I am the creator of the universe, and my standards are all in all, what I say is right, what I say is wrong, the idea of God setting standards is the idea of absolutism. So that there really is, whoops, got to take the offering. Yes, the ushers have come forward and do that. Thank you. The idea of absolutism is foreign to humanism. Rather, it isn't so much thou shalt not steal, but it's thou shalt not steal normally. That is, there may be certain cases when it would be all right to steal. Thou shalt not commit adultery ordinarily. But there might be instances where it would be right to commit adultery. It all depends on what serves man, on what is best for man. I mentioned that evolution is a prime contributor to this kind of thought. I say the theory of evolution because man, in that theory, is simply an advanced piece of matter. He has no real character. He has no real divine order to follow. Simply a matter of what his environment makes him. It's only what forces were at work in forming man. That is what makes man what he is. The idea of a spirit or a soul or a free will is lost in a theory of evolution because man is simply the product of his environment. He's made by what is around him. This is the essence of the evolutionary hypothesis. And so, consequently, man really is not a responsible creature in the sense that he really isn't responsible for what he does because he's only doing what he's been taught to do. And, of course, which is radically wrong. God said, the soul that sins, it shall die. He said, stop sinning. God just said, forget your environment. You obey me. But the humanist says, we must obey our environment. We're under it. We're made by it. We're products of it. I mentioned Freudian psychology and how that it eradicates the idea of human responsibility because everything you are is what your mother told you when you were 2 or 3 years old. It's that mean teacher you had in kindergarten. It's that repressive father of yours. They're the ones that made you the way you are. And what you do now, well, you're simply just playing back what was recorded in your computer when you were a child. It inflicts guilt upon God for inflicting guilt upon people, the idea being that moral standards are evil. And this is something that is very flatly stated in Freudian psychology. Morality is a very bad thing because it suppresses people and they end up with guilt complexes, and guilt complexes cause neuroses. And therefore, the only thing to do, the only moral thing to do is to get rid of morality. And that's what Freud gave us, considered a great thinker. I don't think he was such a great thinker. I rushed through the idea of socialism in the course of the Sunday school hour. Socialism is simply the economic philosophy of humanism. And it's based on the idea, again, that man is a product of his environment. We need to understand this much before we go any further. Because there are a lot of interwoven fabrics that are working around us in terms of philosophy, in terms of the way things are fitting together. And the reasoning behind them stems from these roots. Number one, only what man can measure and understand can be considered truth. Number two, man is a product of his environment. And so what is around him makes him the way he is. Now, from that follows the leap that Karl Marx gave us in his works regarding capitalism, entitled Das Kapital, published in 1850. And he, of course, fabricated the Communist Manifesto before that. But he advanced the idea that your environment is essentially economical, that it's economic determinism of our personalities. And so we are products of our environment, and specifically, Marx said, we are products of our financial environment. So if you live in a society where there's bourgeois, property owners, factory owners, who hold the means of making money, and they exploit the workers, the proletariat, then you are living in a decadent society, and it generates evil, and it generates wickedness, and generates upheaval and human suffering, just like rotting flesh seems to generate maggots. It's the system, is what he said. It's the capitalistic system. What we need then is a socialistic system, where that whole process is eliminated. Now, he's still basing this on a humanistic concept. First of all, the material things are all. It doesn't matter what God says. As a matter of fact, Lenin said that the idea of morality, and I'll read you this quote, really doesn't apply to them. We do not believe in eternal, that is spiritual, long-lasting eternal morality. Our morality is entirely subordinated to the interests of the class struggle. So it's entirely moral for the Chinese communists to slaughter 40 million communists when they took over that nation. And then when I was driving in Seattle shortly after the death of Mao Tse-tung, I saw a banner that says, in memory of Mao Tse-tung, you know, X number of years of remarkable service to humankind. Yes, exterminating 40 million people. What a remarkable service to humankind. But you see, there's a situation ethic in there. You can do anything, lie, cheat, steal, use terrorism, anything, to further the cause of communism as they see it. But he was the one who suggested socialism. So then instead of, and of course socialism as an economic philosophy has been around a long time, but the idea there is not that, is that you eradicate greed, you eradicate selfishness, you eradicate competition by having everybody live at exactly the same level, whether you're a PhD, whether you're a practicing physician, a brain surgeon, or whether you are a ditch digger, you would take home the amount of money you need to live. And if you're very smart and capable, then they'll send you to college, and of course it's all free, and you don't work your way into anything. Everything you get, everything you make and produce is distributed to the state, distributed to the people, and then you get back what you need. This is basic socialism. It's called equalitarianism, where there's a distributing where all men are equal. And all that is the attempt to align the environment in such a way that men will get over their sinful natures, is basically what it comes down to. You see, what socialism, what humanism, what these things are really trying to do is trying to eradicate man's selfish nature, man's fallen nature, because people are innately selfish. They are. They're self-seeking. That's why capitalism works so well. You give people a profit incentive and watch them go. And then you take away the incentive to better themselves and improve their own conditions and watch things fall flat. Interesting point is that in the Soviet Union, the farming families are forced to work on collective farms, which are ridiculously underproductive. They're pathetically underproductive. So that the Soviet Union, with tremendous amount more land mass than the United States, who employs 70% to 80% of its people in producing food. I mean, 80% of the Soviet population works in food production, and they're constantly buying grain from the United States, where 4% of the population works at food production, and where we have much less land to work with. But, interesting point, speaking now of how people are innately selfish, now capitalism works, all of the families, the farming families in the Soviet Union, are given 1 acre of land. And it's for them to produce for their own needs. They can grow vegetables on it, they can keep livestock on it, 1 acre. 1 acre. And they can sell whatever they don't need, whatever they don't have to live on. And you know what? Approximately 50% of the vegetables, livestock, and other produce that is generated within the Soviet Union comes off of those 1 acre plots that they're working for themselves. And then the hundreds of acres that are the collective farms where they have to work their own little acre on the weekends, as it were, and then work 100 acres, 500 acres, 1,000 acres, huge rolling hills of wheat, those things can't produce even though they're far larger, they can't produce as much. The reason is people are motivated by the profit motive, and without it, they fall apart. Why should you work hard under socialistic systems? The idea is that for pure joy of giving to your fellow man, that you will do it. But what is more commonly true, and this is a comment made by a Russian defector when he came to the United States, he said, I noticed that on the factories interested in increasing their work output. And do you know why? Because if you increase your work output, they don't increase your pay, they increase your quota. Harder. Why do that? You're not gaining anything excepting simply more to do. And so socialism is the fallen nature of man. Socialism doesn't work because men are too selfish to work in a socialistic system. And if anybody's proven that, it's the Soviet Union. So in any event, the idea of socialism and communism and humanism is something that is contrary to Scripture, something that is contrary to sound economics. And by the way, socialism is not the economic system that the Scripture sets forth, as some people say, but rather it's something that was cooked up by the devil. Now, Francis Schaeffer, in his book, How Shall We Then Live, in discussing the philosophies and the ideas in America today, says this: gradually, that which had become the basic thought form of modern people, speaking of humanism, became almost totally accepted viewpoint. It was the almost totally accepted viewpoint. He says, an almost monolithic consensus. In other words, nearly everybody fit into one philosophy, the philosophy of humanism. And as it came to the majority of people through art, music, drama, theology, and the mass media, he says, values died. That is, the old value systems died. What we're living in today is a puzzling time for many Americans. All they know is we can't seem to do anything right. We can't seem to produce. We're being outproduced. America, which was the industrial giant of the earth, is being outproduced by other industrial nations. The gross national product is not increasing. There isn't as much patriotism. People don't even want to go into the army. You talk about the Russians invading Afghanistan. You talk about prisoners of war. You talk about 50 people being held prisoner in Iran. People get a little upset, but it's nothing like it used to be. When the pirates of the Barbary Coast, back in the early 1800s, were attacking United States shipping, and they didn't have a very big merchant marine in those days, the pirates said, okay, we'll stop attacking you if you'll pay us tribute. And you know what the United States said? Millions for defense, but not 1 cent for tribute. And they gathered an armada, and they sent them over and destroyed the pirates. This was the mentality of America. And today, America can't make up its mind to walk across the street. And what it basically boils down to is the communists are walking all over. Some people shake their heads, they're disgusted, they're frustrated. Something's constantly coming up, and we pat ourselves on the back and say, well, now it could be worse, we've got detente, we've got this. And yet, every year they swallow up more nations. Angola, Ethiopia, Afghanistan, just recently. I mean, you don't have to look in the newspapers very far to discover that there's a constant losing out by the United States. The reason for it is this right here. There's a monolithic consensus in the United States. The United States has been seeded with humanism, and Satan is at the root of it. You see, it isn't a matter simply of one person or a group of people setting down a lie, but there is a fabric of deception that Satan has worked. Christians are concerned. I say Christians are concerned, for example, because prayer and Bible reading has been eliminated from the school. They're disturbed because the Constitution has been amended so that abortions are legal in the United States. They're disturbed because there are laws on the books to protect the right of homosexuals to teach your children in the public schools. They're concerned because laws on sexual responsibility have been repealed so that there are no longer moralistic laws on the books. That bothers Christians. But we're up against something that is called the consensus morality. And what's happening is this: the people in the United States are shifting in their moral standards. They're shifting in their convictions. And as the moral consensus goes, so will the laws go. Listen to this. Here's a quote by a man named Rush Dooney. He's a scholar on the topic of humanism and Christian education. Our society is finding that its laws no longer match up with what people understand as right and wrong. You believe that? That's true. We're having a problem because our laws no longer match up with what people understand as right and wrong. For example, capital punishment, the marijuana laws, laws against sodomy or homosexuality, laws which define marital responsibility, and so on. The legal crisis is due to the fact that the law of Western civilization has been Christian law, but its faith, that is the faith of Christian or Western civilization, is increasingly humanism. The old law is therefore neither understood nor obeyed nor enforced. You see, if you make a law against something to which God objects, and then nobody believes in God or nobody cares what God says, then that law becomes outmoded. And people are confused by it, and so they want to repeal them. They want to change them. You see, people commonly say, well, what we're really doing is we're separating church and state. We're eradicating Christian morality from the legislative processes, from the secular philosophy of government. But you see, that is something that simply cannot and will never be done. Every civil government is a system of laws. Isn't that right? Every civil government is a standard or a system of laws. Agencies, and also it contains the authority for the enforcement in the form of a social order, police system, army, bureaucracy. This is what a government is. That system is a religion in action, because all law is simply enacted morality. You understand what I'm saying? What you do when you make up a system of laws is you decide what is right and what is wrong, and you make laws against the things that are wrong. And then you surround yourself with an order that is capable of perpetuating that system, of stopping wrongdoers and punishing them. Every system is a religion enacted, because religions are systems of morality. And you'll never have law without morality. What is happening is not simply a moving from Christian bias to simple unbiased in the American public. What is happening is Christian morality, which was the basis upon which our laws were originally established, is being thrown over for humanistic morality. It's just another religion. Christianity is being driven from the American courts, driven from the American scene, on the pretense of neutrality. Well, we don't want to affect anybody religiously in our schools, so it isn't right to have any mention of Christmas, any reading of the Bible, any prayer, any anything. We can't even, in a school system in Illinois, wanted to post the Ten Commandments. But because the first three were partisan, because they said, you shall serve the Lord thy God with all thy heart, all thy soul, and all thy strength, they threw them out. And there was a court action that made them do it, even though the parents, the teachers, and the administration all wanted them in there. Unconstitutional. Because you mustn't have a Christian bias. But what they're doing instead is they're substituting the religion of humanism for Christian law. You'll never get away from religious morality. It's just a question of what religion your morality will conform to. That is the question. So he says here, every religion has its own system of law. Thus, we can have a Buddhist state, a Shinto state, an Islamic state, a humanist state, a Christian state, and so on. The United States began with dedication to separate church and state, but to establish a Christian nation. The Bible was seen as the common law of the land. The state can be neutral about churches. That is, you can have a church, you can believe what you wish, you can have any kind of church you wish. But it cannot be neutral about religions, because it cannot exist without law. Whatever system of laws it has will reveal its religious faith. The problem with the United States is that it has exchanged its religious faith on the consensus level. That is, the broad base of opinion has shifted to humanism instead of Christianity. The humanists, however, have promoted the myth of neutrality as a facade for the elimination of Christianity. No man can be neutral to religion, nor can any state. That is, there's no way to be neutral. If you are not for Christ, you're against him. That's what he said. If you believe in humanism, then you disbelieve the Bible. Well, you say, I believe the Bible. All right, you're against humanism. But I don't want to be against any. Well, you are. You cannot be escaped. You cannot be neutral. So he says, no man can be neutral to religion, nor can any state. Every man and every state and all their ways reveal a religious faith. More and more, our humanistic civil officers on federal and state levels are working to remove all marks of Christianity from civil government and replace biblical faith with humanism. A total war is being waged, and no man can escape it. But do you know, my conviction is that very few people even understand that it exists. If humanism is an almost monolithic consensus, as Schaefer put it, in other words, it's just about everybody believes it, or at least has seeds of those things in their mind and heart, the question must be asked, how in the world did it happen? How did people come to throw off Christianity and embrace instead secular humanism, which, by the way, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled is a religion, and it is a religion. It's a moral standard. It's accepting, instead of God being God, man is the God, where man worships himself. He worships his own reason. He worships evolution. But it is a religion. How did Christian America slip away from their Christian roots? Well, Schaefer put it this way, through art, music, drama, theology, mass media, and I'll add this, public education. These are the ways. Note he put in there theology. This is one way America has been led away from the things of God, away from absolutes. Satan is working a fabric of deception in a society. So, with the intent that when everybody believes something, it becomes acceptable and normal. Now, don't underestimate the power of that process. I was listening to the radio last night, and I heard an interview of a homosexual man who lives in Bellevue, who was a school teacher, who has written a book, and he gave his name and so forth. And he argued persuasively for the rights of homosexuals. You know, 10 years ago, that would have floored people to even have that happening. And 50 years ago, that radio station would have gotten so many phone calls, their switchboard operator would have been busy for the next week answering them. Protest! Get them off the air! This is immoral! How dare you air that kind of thing? And yet, because people are used to it, brethren, because they've gotten used to it, because you see that, you know, you experience it, you see them, it's no big deal anymore. And slowly, the consensus is changing. People are changing their views. Satan is trying to work to make light look like darkness and darkness look like light. Isaiah 5 and verse 20, if I could read a scripture from there. God knew that this would happen, and he condemns it here. And this same condemnation applies to anyone who would perpetuate this particular error. But it's a very important thing for Satan to do. He did it with Eve. He said, "You won't die. Something bad won't happen to you. Something good will." So he called something that was evil good. And God, who is good, he said, God doesn't want you to be his gods. He is selfish. God is looking out for himself at your expense. And so he called God, who is good, evil. And he called that which was evil, namely the sin of partaking of the fruit, good. So on that topic, God says in Isaiah 5 and verse 20, "Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe unto those men." Verse 21, "Woe unto them that are wise in their own eyes." My, my, my. We swung right around, didn't we? Right back on the same target. "Ye shall be as gods. You shall discern good and evil. You'll be your own gods. Wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight." They think they're being very prudent, think they're being very wise. Satan is working a fabric of deception so that evil will appear to be good and so that good will appear to be evil. I heard a missionary once who had been to India discuss the difficulty in preaching the gospel in India. He said the reason is that the Indian mentality that's been put there by Hinduism is absolutely contrary to scriptural Christianity. He cited the example of a young girl who was a brand new missionary. She wanted to get out and start witnessing right away, so she said, "Teach me," in the Indian dialect where they were, she said, "teach me in that language the one verse, John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Teach me that much. I'm going to go down and I'm just going to speak it to people on the street." He said, "Won't do a bit of good, and I'll tell you why. Number one, they don't understand a personal God." You see how Satan deceived them? He sowed something right into their culture, right into their mentality. Number one, they don't believe in a personal God. If you talk about God, they're thinking of an entirely different concept than you are. They'll not understand it. God so loved the world. In the Hindu concept, the world is very evil. God doesn't love the world, and neither do they. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. They'll not understand the idea of a son because Satan has trained them to view God in a pantheistic sense. He's not a single person, but God is in everything and of everything. He's a system. He's a spiritual system, not an individual. That he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever believe in him should not perish but have everlasting life. The last thing a Hindu wants to do is live forever. His whole point is to die and reincarnate and die and reincarnate and die and reincarnate and end the processes of life. So that he'll reach the state of nirvana. Now, so she was frustrated. But you know what that exhibits? It shows how Satan can take a culture and he can turn it upside down and affect their thinking in such a way that they are absolutely contrary to the things of God. Now, what I'm saying is he's done something very similar today in the United States. Do you ever wonder why people are so rabid against Christianity? It's not by accident. It's because they've been taught that. You see, the idea of a God who judges evil, the idea of an absolute good, is something that is absolutely foreign to a lot of people's minds. The idea of God being against homosexuality is such a huge thing that God would condemn people for that. And since men are wiser than God, you know, and they set up their own standards, and because man in his own measure and his own experience has decided that maybe it's okay, maybe it's just an alternate lifestyle, God says it's sin. So then they point their finger at God and say, well, this whole system is unrighteous. This is improper. It's got to be the fabrication of biased and bigoted men. And so they throw it overboard. You see, their minds are contrary. The people who argue against capital punishment are arguing against something that God himself in the one instance in the Bible where he had a civil government that he arranged, in that instance, and also in the civil government that God will in the future operate in the millennium when Christ rules the earth, capital punishment was then used and will be again used by God himself. And yet people are, since in a humanistic sense, a criminal is really more of a victim than a perpetrator. He's simply the product of his environment. He's been economically determined, as Marx would say. He's simply an accumulation of accidents. You can't blame the guy for shooting 12 people out of a hotel window. You can't. What good would it do for you to kill him? What good would you need? You owe him something. He was wronged by his parents, you see. And so all of a sudden, God ends up a criminal. And there's a mentality that is being sown into the American public where God comes off wrong, and the society comes off right. That's a strange thing, but it's happening. The question is, how are people coming to have their values completely overturned? Some men and some movements of men are conscientiously aligned with humanism and with socialism and with communism, and they are articulately, specifically, constantly working to change the world into a humanistic, socialistic state. And many others are spiritually aligned with them because they've imbibed the teaching, because they have been listening to the propaganda, and the devil is a master propagandist. They've been listening to the propaganda in the world, and so they sympathize with them. I don't have a lot of time to discuss a lot of detail, but I'm going to mention just a couple things to give you an idea of what is going on. American education has probably as its most primary figure since the early 1900s, when he taught and introduced his ideas, a man named John Dewey. He was the originator of the Dewey Decimal System in our libraries. You ever heard that name, John Dewey? He was the central figure at the Teachers College at Columbia University, Teachers College at Columbia University. Now, this was such a highly respected center for training of educators that fully 20% of all present high school superintendents received advanced degrees from Columbia University. I'm talking about 20% of everyone in the entire nation, and 40% of all teacher colleges, we used to call them normal colleges, 20% of all teacher college heads, that is, heads in some position of administration, 40% of them also received advanced degrees from Columbia University. And the man who set the tune at Columbia University was none other than John Dewey. Perhaps it would be nice to know what John Dewey was like and what he believed. Let me read you a couple phrases here. I'm going to cite some examples from a book by John Stormer. This book has been around since the early 60s, and in my opinion, it ought to be read by everybody in the whole nation. What did Dewey believe? In his writings and teaching, Dewey rejected fixed moral laws and eternal truths and principles. No absolutes. We're back to relativism. He adopted pragmatic, relativistic concepts as his guiding philosophy. When he says pragmatic, he's talking about things that work. You're interested in results. Whatever gets you from point A to point B is all that matters. It's like the communists. If slaughtering a million people gets you from point A to point B, then it's fine. It isn't a matter of man finding out what God's standard is and aligning himself with it and doing things God's way. Instead, he rejects fixed moral laws and adopts pragmatic, relativistic concepts as his guiding philosophy. Denying God, he held to the Marxist concept that man is without a soul or free will. He believed that man was a product of his environment. Now note this. He says that man is a biological organism completely molded by his environment. Dewey believed that because man's environment is constantly changing, man also changes constantly. Therefore, Dewey concluded, teaching children any of the absolutes of morals, government, or ethics was a waste of time. On this amoral philosophy, he developed his teaching for formula commonly labeled progressive education. Dewey published My Pedagogic Creed in 1897. In it, he saw the destruction of a child's individualistic traits as the primary goal of education. The primary goal of education was to destroy children's individualistic traits. Once this was accomplished, the youngster would conform or adjust to whatever society in which he found himself. Ability to get along with the group became the prime measuring stick of a child's educational progress. This is what he taught. Here's a quotation. Dewey summarizes his theories, saying, education, therefore, is a process for living and not a preparation for future living. Now, what it boiled down to is they stopped teaching the empirical studies, the three R's, Latin, history, that kind of thing, and began instead to shape the emotions and the personalities of young people. This whole concept has permeated the educational system in the United States. Dewey laid the foundation for the future destruction of traditional education, decried by Admiral Rickover in a quote previous in this book, when he said, we violate the child's nature, see, because he's environmentally formed. We violate his nature and render difficult the best ethical results by introducing the child too abruptly to a number of special studies of reading, writing, geography, etc. You see, you're going to dissuade him and distract him from what's really important, namely being one of the group, losing his individuality. And so if you introduce him too abruptly to special studies, reading, writing, geography, out of relation to his social life, the true center of correlation of the school subjects is not science, nor literature, nor history, nor geography, but the child's own social activities. And so his idea was not that schools are someplace where you go to learn things, it's school is someplace where you go to become something. And there's a great difference, particularly since Dewey himself was a socialist. As a matter of fact, the climax of his career in 1950 was when he became honorary national chairman of the American counterpart of the British Fabian Society. You ever heard of the Fabian Socialists? How many of you have heard that term? These things are under wraps. But any history book, and I mean any history book, this isn't right wing, this is just basic ABC history, will tell you that the Fabian Socialist Society in England was started by Beatrice and Sidney Webb. George Bernard Shaw was one of the founding members. And they embraced Karl Marx's concept of communism, accepting instead of violent revolution working through the workers, as Bernard Shaw said, it's got to come through the intellectuals of the society. They believe in piecemeal changing over a society until you've sown into people's minds the necessary mentalities for a communist revolution and the changing of things. Dewey visited them. Dewey was also a signer of the first Humanist Manifesto in 1933. Dewey's disciples, whom he trained, George Counts and Harold Rugg in particular, are two of the major figures in American society in regard to education. It was George Counts who outlined in a 17-volume work a social reference, a reference for teachers whereby social behavior could be controlled and altered through education. Let me read you something about this man. I'm going to read from the same book I just mentioned. George Counts was the director of research for a 17-volume study of American education produced by the American Historical Association. Financed by the Carnegie Corporation, the Counts-directed study was to serve as the authoritative guide for revamping the philosophy and Concept of American Education. The final volume, issued in 1934, contained the recommendations of the five-year project, of which the following is typical. Here's what he said. Cumulative evidence supports the conclusion that in the United States, as in other countries, the age of individualism and personal freedom in economy and government is closing, and a new age of collectivism is emerging. This was his philosophy, and this is what he taught, should be taught, to students. At bottom, he continues, and stripped of its carefully neutral phrases, or rather this is a comment by a man named Lasky, who was himself president of the Fabian Society in England, practiced and knowledgeable socialist. He says, at bottom, Kant's ideas, when they're stripped of their carefully neutral phrases, is a report on the educational program for a socialist America. In other words, it's a blueprint for the socializing of America. Kant's hatred of free American economic and political traditions and his socialist goals were stated openly in a paper he presented to the Dewey-founded Progressive Education Association. Here's a quote from it. Historic capitalism, this is a man that wrote a 17-volume set that was a landmark in regard to the teaching of teachers. These are college texts this man wrote. They were used in the training of teachers. Here's what he says. Historic capitalism, with its deification of the principle of selfishness, its reliance upon the forces of competition, its placing of property above human rights, and its exaltation of the profit motive, will either have to be displaced altogether or so radically changed in form and spirit that its identity will be completely lost. This is his concept. Harold Rugg is another man I mentioned as being a disciple of Dewey in the educational system. Here is a couple comments regarding him. Schools were to be used to transform American political and economic institutions and create new public mind, which would accept the complete government control of the individual. Here's what Rugg said. Through the schools of the world, we shall disseminate might be a better word, but it isn't what is written here. Through the schools of the world, we'll disseminate a new conception of government, one that will embrace all of the collective activities of men, one that will postulate the need for scientific control and operation of economic activities in the interest of all people. This is what he was after. Training people to be world citizens instead of U.S. citizens. Now, the way they did this, and one major way they did it, was to do their best to downplay patriotism. And so, for example, histories of the United States were rewritten so that the United States was not put in nearly such glowing terms. And heroes, say of the United States Revolution, George Washington being a prime example, were downplayed. And so whereas he's seen as the father of his country, the first in war, the first in peace, first in the heart of his countrymen, now the history books discuss how he was a gambler, how he sexually abused his slaves, how he was a slaveholder, etc. I was a cold man, and how, you know, his motives were impure. These are the kind of things that are taught with the intent of lowering the patriotic and nationalistic sense of the students. The idea is that they'll be trending, that they'll be bent towards socialism. Class hatred didn't exist in America up until a few years ago when these fellows helped us out. Here's another quote by George Count. He says this, and he's writing in a magazine titled The Social Frontiers. He writes, in the view of the absence of a class mentality among workers, it would be reasonable to assume that it is the problem of education to induce such a mentality rather than to take an existing mentality and base a course of action upon it. In other words, he said, it's the job of the schools to induce a class mentality. Now, here's a quote from a textbook on American history. Speaking of the first Constitutional Convention, it says, the delegates were conservative or slow to change, and that is easy to understand. They were the property-holding class, speaking of the men who constituted the original Constitution. Now, that's an interesting thought. Oh, you mean it was the aristocracy that formulated the U.S. Constitution? So it is designed to protect the property-holding classes. What about the poor workers? But what they don't tell you here is that 90% of the inhabitants of the American colonies were property holders. Everybody practically owned property. But they're trying to draw a picture here of the upper class, the bourgeois, and the proletariat, the workers, attempting to instill a socialist vision for people, the idea of coming up and taking over things, the idea that they have been slighted. And frankly, without going into any detail, the idea of many of the civil rights struggles, many of the claims and the various rightist groups that have been forming up, they're all outgrowths of this thing. They're all basic. They're all basically coming from the same direction, the idea of a class struggle. Everybody was happily working, making a living, and having a home and defending their freedom before they were educated. And now people are educated, and we see what is happening. They're being educated by the wrong men. A man named Magruder wrote a textbook for use in American high schools entitled American Government. It's a study, this author says, in propaganda techniques. The class struggle idea is reinforced in this passage, which uses false premise to discourage thrift, saving, and family responsibility and justify welfare payments for all. Socialism would be a welfare state. Look what this fellow says. This is what your students are studying in high school. Because of sickness, accidents, and occasional unemployment, it is difficult or impossible for a laborer, and notice how he uses the word laborer. It's as if either you're a fat cat sitting in a Wall Street office or you're a poor laborer someplace. It's like there are two extremes. But what he's talking about is a working man. He says, because of the sicknesses, accidents, occasional unemployment, it's difficult or impossible for a laborer who has reared a family to save from his meager wages, which is totally wrong. It's not true at all. But they say it's right. And it is more just to place all the burden of supporting those who have been unfortunate. In other words, if they have an accident, if they have some difficulty, it is more just to place that burden of supporting those who have been unfortunate or even shiftless upon everybody instead of upon some dutiful son or daughter who is not responsible for the condition. He's saying, well, since their children, let's say dad, he's 55 years old, his children are grown, he slips and falls at work and he can't live for 6 months, or he can't work for 6 months, then it would only be right to make society support him instead of some dutiful son or daughter whose fault it is and you're not responsible for the condition. Of course, the implication of what he says here is that we are responsible. The taxpayers are responsible for the fact that somebody fell or somebody has a problem. Now, I'm not against helping other people, but you see what he's saying here, and notice he used the word shiftless. It's only normal, it's only just, he suggests, for those in America to support those who are either unable or unwilling to work. The idea is that everybody should get a piece of the pie, which is basic socialism. But this isn't supposed to be a socialistic textbook. It's supposed to be an American history. I want to note a story here that shocked me. How many of you ever had stories when you were in school that you read in your primers, say about the little red hen who sowed wheat and harvested it and cooked bread and wouldn't share it with her lazy friends who always wanted to help her eat? You ever read those stories? Or, for example, the story about the little squirrel who played around all summer and didn't store up anything against the winter, or perhaps the grasshopper who played and didn't store up anything, and then when winter came, they were in want and in desperate condition. And the moral was, work and you'll eat, store up against difficult times, be diligent. Well, that's all been rewritten. For today's six-year-old, the new version is entitled, Ask for It. Now, here's a quotation, or actually this is a description of a story that actually appears in a first grade reader entitled Our New Friends, published by the Scott Forsman Company in 1956. In this story, a little squirrel named Bobby ate nuts from a tree during the summer. Other squirrels suggested that Bobby put some nuts away for winter. As Bobby's squirrel didn't like to work, he ignored the advice. Winter came, and one morning Bobby awakened to find the world covered with snow, and all the nuts were gone from the tree. He got awfully hungry, but remembered that a boy who lived in a white house, that's remarkable, the White House, you get it? A boy who lived in a white house had taken some of the nuts from his tree during the summer. You get it? You see, somebody in the White House had taken some of the nuts from his tree during the summer. Bobby went to the White House and gave a squirrel call. A door opened and a fine, quote, fine brown nut, unquote, rolled out. Bobby Squirrel learned his lesson. The story concludes, and this is a quote from the story, well, thought Bobby, I know how to get my dinner. All I have to do is ask for it, unquote. So much for the little red hen. Unfortunately, the trees that are being picked are the trees of the workers, and those are the wage earners, those who are producing in the United States. But do you see what kind of mentality that is fostering? These are six-year-olds that are reading this, see? They're teaching something with that. They're teaching something with it. There's an international education association called UNESCO, which stands for United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. Got that? Those of you who are taking notes, I'm sure you got that down. The goal of UNESCO was stated plainly in regarding what it wanted to do. Now, the Education Association of the United States are working with UNESCO. They are sympathetic with their goals. It says, children should be educated in those qualities of citizenship which provide the foundation upon which international government must be based if it is to succeed. In other words, preparing world government citizens, not nationalistic children. You want them to have world government instincts. Note what they say here about you parents teaching your kids. You're a dangerous lot, according to UNESCO. They say, as we have pointed out, it is frequently the family that infects, notice their choice of words there, it's like you gave them smallpox, you infect the child with extreme nationalism, that is love of country, that is proud to be an American. The school should therefore use the means described earlier to combat family attitudes. Did you know that your public school systems are attempting to combat the very things that you're trying to teach your children? In our view, they say, history and geography should be taught at this stage, and by the way, this is a quotation from a teaching manual that is distributed to teachers, public school teachers, again used in teachers' colleges. In our view, they say, history and geography should be taught at this stage as universal history and geography. Of the two, only geography lends itself well to study during the years prescribed by the present survey, that is, younger children under the age of 13. They're saying, teach them geography, teach them land boundaries, mountain ranges, the location of capital cities, and all of that. The study of history, on the other hand, raises problems of value, which are better postponed until the pupil is freed from the nationalist prejudices which at present surround the teaching of history. In other words, translated, this means that if the grade school student is taught American history objectively, he's very likely to realize that the American system of government, economics, and social values outstrip those found anywhere else in the world. Don't tell them about the founding of the nation. Don't tell them how America differs from other countries, but emphasize the sameness of them. One more quote. Certain delicate problems, however, will arise in these studies and explorations, speaking of the study of history and development of nations. Not everything in foreign ways of living can be presented to children in an attractive light. And we wouldn't want them to think that the communists live anything below us. We wouldn't want them to think that socialism isn't a grand and great system and that every nation has freedom like America. Not everything in foreign ways of living can be presented to children as in an attractive light. At this stage, though, the systematic examination of other countries and manners can be postponed, and the teacher needs seek only to ensure that his children appreciate through abundant and judicious examples that foreign countries, too, possess things of beauty, and that many of them resemble the beauty and interest in his own country. A child taught thus about the different countries of the world will gradually lose those habits of prejudice and contempt which are an impediment to world-mindedness. See, they want to teach children to be little collectivists, and this is the mentality they're attempting to place. I mentioned that there's a specific, oh, I should mention, too, the United Nations Charter, by the way, was done by, was worked on. The United States sent delegates to found the United Nations, and just as luck would have it, the delegates we sent later turned out to be Soviet agents. Did you know that? Soviet agents were our representatives in the founding of the United Nations Charter. That's why you drive along and you see signboards by right-wing political people. They'll say, get us out of the United Nations. The United Nations isn't doing the United States a bit of good, and that is the truth. It was never designed to. It was designed to break down the national strength of the country. Not so much for spiritual purposes as for political ones, because you can't have a world government unless you have people who are willing to acquiesce to world government, unless you have collective minds form. So this is the kind of thing that's been going on in our educational processes, and it boils down in various subtle ways until the children that are being raised today have practically no national pride, and that's the truth. Remember Romeo mentioned when he got home from Vietnam, to risking his life in defense of his country's honor, people, and he wore his uniform on the East Coast, and people hollered, killer, killer, at him. Is that the way they treated World War II veterans, World War I veterans? Oh, no. But today, you see, people view the United States as immoral. They do. And there are many authors who are piling on all kinds of things about how we wronged the Indians and we wronged the Iranians and we've done this, we're imperialistic, and people are actually in America, they're buying the socialistic line that America is really an awful place to live. The irony of it is, if you send any American into any socialistic system for, I would say, more than 5 minutes, they would be so disgusted, so shocked, so torn up, so against all of that, that I doubt they'd complain against the American system again. But I'm not saying this as a political speech. I'm not bringing you these things so that we'll all get wound up patriotically, but so that we'll understand that Satan has been sowing the seeds of world government and humanism into our society, and he's used education to do it. One more point, one more area, I should say, and that is religion. I need to read you another quote. Here's a statement that was made about a particular theologian. Dr. A.W. Bevan, a former president of the Federal Council of Churches of Christ in America, he wrote in 1937, "It is clear, it seems to me, that the greatest single influence on the life and thought," now listen, "the greatest single influence on the life and thought of the American church in the last 50 years was exerted by Walter Rauschenbusch." How many of you ever heard of Walter Rauschenbusch? None of you. Well, Mike. "And yet he's had the greatest single influence on the American church in the last 50 years. Who was Rauschenbusch? Well, I need to read you a little bit more. Rauschenbusch and his social gospel. Does that ring a bell? He was the originator of the social gospel. Rauschenbusch and his social gospel, this author states, provided the philosophy for the collectivist movement which has drained much of American Protestantism of its effect on man and his life. Dr. Harry F. Ward contributed to the organizational and conspiratorial genius to the movement. Rauschenbusch was the one who concocted social salvation. He believed that man was environmentally determined. That is, he believed that you become whatever you're surrounded by. And so then, to save men and to save society, don't preach the gospel of human regeneration to the Holy Spirit, but instead, change society. And then you'll rectify all the wrongs and all the evils that exist. You see, this was his idea. It was basically a restatement of the Marxist dogma of economic determinism. Change the economic environment, and man will be transformed. He graduated from Rochester Theological Seminary in 1885. He was a confirmed socialist even before making a trip to Europe in 1907 to visit with Beatrice and Sidney Webb, founders with atheist George Bernard Shaw, the famous playwright of the British Fabian Society. Rauschenbusch was a shrewd practitioner of the Fabian methodology, who realized that if he identified socialism as such in his preaching and teaching, many people in the church would be repelled. Therefore, in his new theology, Rauschenbusch promised a kingdom of God on earth. As early as 1893, Rauschenbusch wrote, "The only power that can make socialism succeed if it is established is religion. It cannot work in an irreligious country." I mentioned Ward was a disciple of Rauschenbusch. In 1908, he was the founder of the oldest officially cited communist front group in America. The oldest officially cited by the U.S. government, a communist front group in America. And you know what it was? The Methodist Federation of Social Action, found by your own government to be a communist front organization. And Harry F. Ward established it. A year later, he played a part in organizing the Federal Council of Churches. The forerunner, this is interesting, Harry F. Ward, who was an identified communist, by the way, under oath, he was declared to be a communist in court of law. He was the one who played a part in organizing the Federal Council of Churches, forerunner of the present-day National Council of Churches. Isn't that interesting? He's been an organizer, a promoter of nearly every important communist front activity in America since. In September of 61, while in his 80s, this durable old man was a keynote speaker at an officially sponsored communist rally in New York, which protested the action of the Supreme Court in branding the Communist Party USA as a communist-controlled organization. They didn't like that. Identified under oath as a communist by Benjamin Gitlow, first head of the Communist Party USA. Gitlow, who was the head of the Communist Party, said under oath that Ward was a communist. Manning Johnson, one-time leader of the party's Negro section and several others, Ward was branded as the Red Dean of the religious field before a committee of U.S. Congress. Ward posed as a Methodist, But for 25 years, he infected hundreds of young ministers of all denominations with his blasphemous ideas as a professor of Christian ethics at Union Theological Seminary. Isn't that interesting? So here's an identified communist who holds a responsible position for training of ministers at one of the most respected seminaries in the United States. No wonder they started calling them cemeteries. Ward recruited pupils, associates, and disciples to his crusade to produce, in his own words, a changed attitude on the part of many church members concerning the purpose and function both of the church and Christianity. He wanted to change the direction of the church because they were talking about spiritual salvation, but he was oriented towards socialist salvation instead. An independent group of Methodist clergy and laymen called the Circuit Riders did an evaluation of all the clergymen, Protestant clergymen, who in any way were associated with Communist Front organizations, and they came up with over 7,000 ministers and theological school professors who have supported Communist Fronts and causes in the United States alone. You see, the church has been sown with the same leaven. The congressional hearings on the much-smeared Air Reserve Training Manual, Air Reserve Training Manual said that the churches had been infiltrated by communism, watch out for the churches, and so there was a big court hearing over it. But the congressional hearings in that case cited the names of a few leading fellow travelers in the ministry. They included Walter Russell Bowie, who was affiliated with 33 Communist Fronts, and then they name off several other prominent Protestant scholars. These five men and 25 others with records of support for communist causes served on the committee of 95 Bible scholars, translators, and theologians who produced the Revised Standard Version of the Holy Bible. So you have Communist Front people, supporters of Communist Front organizations, filling 30% of the 95 translators on that committee. 30% of them were in Communist Front organizations. That's the Revised Standard Version of the Bible. And so let me change books here a minute. This is incredible. Let me read you another quote about a man named J.C. Bennett, who happened to be the president of Union Theological Seminary. A lot of people today don't know it, but the churches have supported various unrighteous causes through the decades, including the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, and so forth. Here's a quote by Bennett, who's the president of the Union Theological Seminary. Says Bennett rejects even the unchanging authority of the Scriptures. He told a meeting of the Associated Church Press that, quote, neither the Bible nor tradition nor theology provides a static authority for ethical questions. Static meaning stationary. In other words, you can't even trust the Bible. Here's what he does say. He recommends that Christian stands on economic, social, and political questions be developed by a consensus or a majority of opinion of churchmen from a wide variety of cultural and national backgrounds. In other words, when any issue arises, rather than looking to the unchanging authority of the Scriptures, Bennett suggests getting a group of clergymen together to decide what's best. Other church leaders have similar views. And note this. Joseph F. Fletcher, professor of ethics at Cambridge Episcopal Theological School, favors amending the Ten Commandments to read, "Thou shalt not covet ordinarily. Thou shalt not kill ordinarily. Thou shalt not commit adultery ordinarily." By the way, Joe Fletcher was identified in another book as being a worker for the communist cause, a specific agent of the communist cause in America. Fletcher says, "For me, there are no rules, not at all." And here comes our situation ethics again. Anything and everything is right or wrong according to the situation. Here's a teacher of ethics yet in a theological seminary. Depends on the situation. What is wrong in some cases is right in others. A situationist would discard all absolutes except the one absolute, always to act with loving concern. There are many, many quotations here. Let me read you a couple of the teachings that are being given out in the name of Christianity by these types of organizations. For example, the Christian Churches, Disciples of Christ, Evangelical United Brethren, United Church of Christ, and the United Presbyterian Church in the USA publish four times a year a magazine entitled Campus Encounter for distribution on college campuses. This is a Christian publication. An article, Love Without Fear, which was included in Volume 3, Number 4, published in the winter of 1965. The author advocated and described in detailed language which most postmasters would not accept for mailing all types of sexual activity between old men and little boys, boys and girls, and young adults. After picturing a utopian society where anything would go sexually, the author concluded, and he quotes here, "May I make it clear that I think these people would be free sexually in ways that are perhaps startling to us. It would be love of bodies in all their different aspects. It would be bisexual, and that there would not be the kind of fear that keeps two men from embracing and showing affection in this society. For in the age of nakedness and freedom, there would be much self-confidence. It is a great and exciting challenge, something to aspire and hope for. Someday, perhaps, we will know a few others, real people whom we can love without fear and with whom we can become real. The magazine which published this article was distributed on college campuses in the name of Christianity using Christian funds. Here's another quote. In December of 1967, Lewis Maddox, an official of the United Church of Christ, writing in Social Action, official publication of the church, recommended that the church, quote, cease whatever discrimination exists against homosexuals per se in admission to seminaries and ordination and employment and national denomination and local church staff. A conference of 90 Episcopalian priests held by the Diocese of New York, Connecticut, Long Island, and Newark concluded that, quote, homosexual acts between consenting adults are, quote, morally neutral. Such acts, they decided, should be judged individually on the basis of whether the participants are expressing genuine love or are simply using each other for selfish purposes. There's your humanism for you. Only this is a theological humanism. This is a displacing of Christian truth with humanistic ideas, still using Christian ideas. The National Council of Churches publishes a booklet that says, for the Christian there are no laws, no rules, no regulations. Life is a series of grays and not pure blacks and whites. This position is justified by the National Council of Churches booklet on the basis that while the Old Testament adultery was strictly forbidden, as were other sexual deviations, quote, both Jesus and the Apostle Paul were seeking to set men free from this sort of legalistic bondage. Isn't that nice to know? The Lord Jesus came to set you free from the legalistic bondage against sexual deviancy. Yes, you're free in the New Testament time. This is incredible. And yet it goes on and on and on and on. And time fails me as space fails me, as John wrote, to cite a lot of other things. And there are other factors in our society besides that of education and religion where there is an infiltration of these kinds of ideas. I didn't mention the possession of socialistic bents by the mass media, by the news reporting, but these things are documented and perfectly true, that when you hear the news, it's likely, more than likely, to be slanted against conservatives, against patriotism, against capitalism, and for socialism. I didn't mention anything about the government of the United States being infiltrated by Soviet agents and other fellow travelers that are sympathetic with the socialistic cause. Since the Senate Committee on Un-American Activities has been disbanded as being unpopular, with the death of J. Edgar Hoover and a few watchdogs, the depreciation of the CIA and the FBI as investigative organizations, with the growing guilt of Americans over looking into anything and looking over anybody's shoulder, the newspapers have practically ceased to print any reference to espionage by communist nations within the borders of the United States. And yet, if it has done anything, it has increased tenfold over what it was back in the days of the McCarthy era, back when Alger Hiss, Owen Lattimore, and the other communist agents were exposed in the U.S. government. It's little known that China was purposely lost because during the nationalist versus the communist fighting there, the churches came in strongly on the side of the agrarian reformers, which was Mao Tse-tung and his bandits. People don't know that Chiang Kai-shek was a Western sympathizer and a Christian man, and that he was basically betrayed by the U.S. State Department, who didn't send him enough aid to support his, even though they were told to do it. So a few officials in high places that were since found out to have communist sympathies stopped the aid, and so China was lost with no necessity, no reason whatever for that war to have been lost, an entire 4 billion people lost into communism because of that. Most Americans don't know that the United States had specific information while they were still supporting Castro's revolution in Cuba that he was a communist. They knew that. They knew it. But they didn't do anything about it. Top commanders in Korea and America on the American side said that there was an outflow from the U.S. State Department of all of their major tactics in the whole conflict that was being given to the opposition, given to the North Koreans. The head man of the United Nations effort against North Korea was the Russian delegate, was a Russian general, And Russia were the ones that were supporting North Korea against the United Nations. Most people are not aware that the major communications of our government with other governments, including many secret ones, classified ones, travel over an overseas cable that is maintained by a trade union that is dominated by the Communist Party, shot through with communism, so that all of our communications travel. These things are not common knowledge, and yet they are all around us, and there's a constant effect. And when these things became known back in the 50s, the communists and the socialists and their sympathizers and their dupes launched an anti-communist crusade to smear everybody who raised a dissenting voice. And so now you don't hear any dissenting voices, except a very few. But that doesn't mean that the processes have stopped. Almost done. What can a Christian do? Three things. Number one, come out from among them, my people. There's a working here attempting to draw Christians into situation ethics, attempting to draw Christians into world government, attempting to draw Christians into humanism, into socialism. The thing to do is to learn the truth. And I'm not saying align yourself politically with this side or that side. God hasn't called Christians to be political activists, but he has called them to know the truth and to live the truth. Reverse the trend of humanism in your own heart by submitting wholly to God. Don't fall for that old line, you shall be as gods. You'll decide what's good and evil. You let God decide what is good and evil. And lastly, be a light in the world. The kingdom of God is going to be a spiritual one. You'll never recover a political stability by getting active politically, by lobbying and mailing money to Washington, D.C., and doing this and doing that. In my opinion, that is largely a waste of time. And the reason is that the reason we're in the place we are now is that the consensus morality has shifted to the left. And the only way that you're ever going to improve things in the United States, if indeed that's what you wish to do, is for the consensus morality to shift back. And there's only one way to do that. It's in individual hearts. It's for men to know Christ. It's for men to love God. This is the answer. There really is no political answer in the sense that the Antichrist is coming and there isn't a thing you or I are going to do about it to stop him, because the Bible has already told us he will come. But what we can affect is who follows him and who is deceived by him, who is going to heaven and who isn't, and whether or not people really see the true Jesus. These are the things that we've got to do. This is God's calling. One scripture, John 9, verses 4 and 5. Some Christians are inclined, when they get all this information, to throw their hands in the air and shout, glory, hallelujah. We're all going to heaven soon. Jesus has to be coming. But while that is true, we have yet a job to do here on the earth. John 9, verse 4. Jesus said, I must work the works of him that sent me, while it is the day. The night cometh when no man can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. You remember in Matthew 6 where he told the disciples, you are the light of the world? Brethren, as long as we are in the world, we must do the works of him that sent us, and we must be the light of the world. You know how you become a light? You become a liver of the truth. You become a possessor and an expression in your daily life of the truth of Christ. Well, I hope this helps us in regard to some of the things that are going on. Perhaps God will be able to quicken these things to our hearts and minds and make us wise unto salvation. Keep us out of this system and into the things of God. Let's stand.